Hello and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a feature article by Paquette et al. Refusals of the Determination of Death by Neurologic Criteria, a Mixed Methods Study of Physician Perspectives on Refusals Cases. Objectives. Refusals to allow examination for determination of death by neurologic criteria challenge pediatric physicians and create distress for medical teams and families of patients suspected to meet criteria for death by neurologic criteria. The objective of this study was to inquire about and assess experiences with such refusals from the perspective of physicians. Design. We conducted a mixed methods survey and interview-based study to understand physicians' experiences with refusals. Setting. An online survey was sent to pediatric intensivists and neurologists. Phone interviews were conducted in a subset. Participants. The study included 80 physician survey respondents and 12 interview physician respondents. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Refusals occur for many reasons regarding patients with both acute and progressive brain injury. The most common reasons were consistent in surveys and interviews and include waiting on a miracle, not wanting to give up, religious objections, and disbelief in brain death. Time was an important mediator in many cases. Physicians described several approaches to managing refusals, highlighting the impact on medical teams, distraction from other patients, and need for resources to support physicians. Conclusions. Refusals may have important sociodemographic associations that should be considered in managing complex cases. Physicians seek more guidance in law and policies to manage refusals. Abstract 2 is a feature article by Lin et al. Caring for critically ill children with the ICU Liberation Bundle, or ABCDEF, results of the Pediatric Collaborative. Objectives. Assess clinical outcomes following PICU Liberation ABCDEF bundle utilization. Design. Prospective multicenter cohort study. Setting. 8 academic PICUs. Patients. Children greater than 2 months with expected PICU stay greater than 2 days and need for mechanical ventilation. Interventions. ABCDEF bundle implementation. Measurements and main results. Over an 11-month period with 3-month baseline and 8-month implementation, bundle utilization was measured for 622 patients totaling 5,017 PICU days. Risk of mortality was quantified for 532 patients or 4,275 PICU days for correlation between bundle utilization and mechanical ventilation duration, PICU length of stay, delirium incidence, and mortality. Utilization was analyzed as subject-specific, defined as entire PICU stay, and day-specific, defined as single PICU day. Median overall subject-specific utilization increased from 50% during the 3-month baseline to 63.9% during the last 4 implementation months, with a p-value less than 0.001. Subject-specific utilization for elements A and C did not change. Utilization improved for B, D, E, and F. Utilization improved for B from 0 to 12.5% with a p-value equal to 0.007, for D from 22.2 to 61.1% with a p-value less than 0.001, for E from 17.7 to 50% with a p-value equal to 0.003, and for F from 50 to 79.2% with a p-value equal to 0.001. We observed no association between bundle utilization and mechanical ventilation duration, PICU length of stay, or delirium incidence. In contrast, on adjusted analysis, every 10% increase in subject-specific utilization correlated with mortality odds ratio reduction of 34% and a p-value less than 0.001. Every 10% increase in day-specific utilization correlated with the mortality odds ratio reduction of 1.4%, with a p-value equal to 0.006. Conclusions. ABCDEF bundle is applicable to children. Although enhanced bundle utilization correlated with decreased mortality, increased utilization did not correlate with duration of mechanical ventilation, PICU length of stay, or delirium incidence. Additional research in the domains of comparative effectiveness, implementation science, and human factors engineering is required to understand this clinical inconsistency and optimize PICU liberation concept integration into clinical practice. Abstract 3 is a clinical investigation by DeMeyer et al. The relationship between esophageal pressure and diaphragm thickening fraction in spontaneously breathing sedated children, a feasibility study. Objectives: diaphragm ultrasound is a novel alternative to esophageal pressure measurements in the evaluation of diaphragm function and activity, but data about its reliability in a pediatric setting are lacking. We aimed to compare the esophageal pressure swing with the diaphragmatic thickening fraction as a measure of inspiratory effort in sedated children. Additionally, we studied the effect of positive end expiratory pressure on the end expiratory thickness of the diaphragm. Design: prospective open-label non-randomized interventional physiological cohort study. Setting: operating room in a tertiary academic hospital. Patients: children 28 days to 13 years old scheduled for elective surgery with general anesthesia, spontaneously breathing through a laryngeal mask airway, were eligible for inclusion. Exclusion criteria were disorders or previous surgery of the diaphragm, anticipated difficult airway, or acute cardiopulmonary disease. All measurements were performed prior to surgery. Interventions: patients were subjected to different levels of respiratory load, PEEP, and anesthetic depth in a total of 7 respiratory conditions. Measurements and main results: the esophageal pressure and diaphragm thickening fraction were simultaneously recorded for 5 breaths at each respiratory condition. The relation between esophageal pressure swing and diaphragmatic thickening fraction was studied in a mixed model. We analyzed 407 breaths in 13 patients. Both diaphragmatic thickening fraction with a p-value equal to 0.03 and esophageal pressure swing with a p-value equal to 0.002 could detect respiratory activity, and esophageal pressure swing and diaphragmatic thickening fraction were associated across respiratory conditions with a p-value less than 0.001 and an R-square value equal to 31%. With increasing inspiratory load, esophageal pressure swing increased significantly, while diaphragmatic thickening fraction did not, with a p-value equal to 0.008. Additionally, diaphragmatic thickening fraction did not differ significantly between 10, 5, and 0 centimeters of water of PEEP, with a p-value equal to 0.08. Conclusions: in spontaneously breathing sedated children and across different respiratory conditions, diaphragmatic thickening fraction could differentiate minimal or no inspiratory effort from substantial inspiratory effort and was associated with esophageal pressure swing. Increased efforts resulted in higher esophageal pressure swing, but not larger diaphragmatic thickening fraction. Abstract 4 is a clinical investigation by Undar et al. Centrifugal or roller blood pumps for neonatal veno-venous extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, extracorporeal life support organization database comparison of mortality and morbidity. Objectives: to investigate outcomes associated with conventional roller or centrifugal pumps during neonatal veno-venous extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO. Our primary hypothesis is that in comparison with conventional roller pump support, centrifugal pump use is associated with greater odds of survival. Our secondary hypothesis is that centrifugal pump use is associated with lesser odds of complications. Design: retrospective cohort identified using the Extracorporeal Life Support Organization, or ELSO, registry 2016 to 2020 dataset. Setting: all ECMO centers reporting to the ELSO registry. Patients: all neonates less than or equal to 28 days supported with veno-venous ECMO and cannulated via right internal jugular vein using dual-lumen veno-venous cannulas and polymethylpentene membrane oxygenators. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: a total of 612 neonates were included in the analysis, including 340 on centrifugal pumps and 272 on conventional roller pumps. Using a multivariable logistic regression model, centrifugal pump use, as opposed to roller pump use, was associated with lesser odds of survival, with an odds ratio of 0.53, a 95% confidence interval of 0.33 to 0.84, and a p-value less than 0.008. Thrombosis and clots in the circuit components were also associated with lesser odds of survival, with an odds ratio of 0.28, a 95% confidence interval of 0.16 to 0.6, and a p-value less than 0.001. We failed to show that hemolysis was an independent variable for survival, with an odds ratio of 0.6, a 95% confidence interval of 0.31 to 1.19, and a p-value equal to 0.14. The primary diagnosis of neonatal aspiration or meconium aspiration is associated with more than sevenfold greater odds of survival, with an odds ratio of 7.57, a 95% confidence interval of 4.02 to 15.74, and a p-value less than 0.001. Conclusions. Contrary to our hypotheses, conventional roller pump use was associated with greater odds of survival, while thrombosis and clots in circuit components were independent variables for lesser odds of survival. Further research is needed to better understand the use of centrifugal pumps in neonatal practice. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation by Six Samuels et al., a novel comprehensive algorithm for evaluation of PICU patients with new fever or instability. Objectives. There is variation in microbiology testing among PICU patients with fever, offering opportunities to reduce avoidable testing and treatment. Our objective is to describe the development and assess the impact of a novel comprehensive testing algorithm to support judicious testing practices and expanded diagnostic differentials for PICU patients with new fever or instability. Design. A mixed methods quality improvement study. Setting. Single-center academic PICU and pediatric cardiac ICU. Subjects. Admitted PICU patients and physicians. Interventions. A multidisciplinary team developed a clinical decision support algorithm. Measurements and main results. We evaluated blood, endotracheal, and urine cultures, urinalyses, and broad-spectrum antibiotic use per 1,000 ICU patient days using statistical process control charts and incident rate ratios, and assessed clinical outcomes 24 months pre and 18 months post-implementation. We surveyed physicians weekly for 12 months post-implementation. Blood cultures declined by 17%, with an incident rate ratio of 0.83 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.77 to 0.89. Endotracheal cultures by 26%, with an incident rate ratio of 0.74 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.63 to 0.86. And urine cultures by 36%, with an incident rate ratio of 0.64 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.56 to 0.73. There was an anticipated rise in urinalysis testing by 23%, with an incident rate ratio of 1.23 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.14 to 1.33. Despite higher acuity and fewer brief hospitalizations, mortality, hospital, and PICU readmissions were stable, and PICU length of stay declined. Of the 108 physician surveys, 46 replied, or 43%, and 39, or 85% of those, recently used the algorithm. 0 reported patient safety concerns, 2, or 4%, provided constructive feedback, and 28, or 61%, reported the algorithm improved patient care. Conclusions. A comprehensive fever algorithm was used with reductions in blood, endotracheal, and urine cultures, and anticipated increase in urinalyses. We detected no patient harm, and physicians reported improved patient care. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation by Feldman et al. Low diagnostic utility of frequent serial tracheal aspirate cultures in the PICU. Objectives. To determine the diagnostic outcomes of serial tracheal aspirate cultures in the PICU. Design. A retrospective chart review of tracheal aspirate culture utilization was performed. Items recorded for each tracheal aspirate culture included the time and date of culture acquisition, result, changes in microbial resistance patterns, antimicrobial therapy, and patient clinical course. Setting: a single urban tertiary care children's hospital in the United States. Subjects: patients admitted to the PICU from January 1st to October 31st, 2021, for whom a tracheal aspirate culture was performed. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. 150 unique subjects had 582 tracheal aspirate cultures performed during this study period, of which 145, or 24.9%, were serially repeated within 72 hours. Of these serial tracheal aspirate cultures, 82, or 56.6%, had no growth, 41, or 28.3%, grew the same organism as the prior culture, with most, 36 of 41, displaying no major change in antimicrobial susceptibilities. 11, or 7.6%, grew a new organism previously grown during the admission, and 11, or 7.6%, grew a new organism not previously grown during the emission. Overall, only 26 of these serial tracheal aspirate cultures, or 17.9%, provided new diagnostic information, whereas only 5, or 3.4%, led to a change in management. Conclusions. Frequent serial tracheal aspirate culture sampling in the PICU is common and infrequently yields new data that impact clinical decision-making. Considering worsening antimicrobial resistance and the role of diagnostic stewardship in mitigating it, these findings further support a 72-hour reassessment period before performing a repeat tracheal aspirate culture in critically ill children. Abstract 7 is a PCCM trial by Goldstein et al., the effects of expectation setting and bundle consent on acute caregiver stress in the PICU, a randomized control trial. Objectives. Having a child admitted to the PICU is a stressful experience for parents and can have long-term negative mental health consequences. The objective was to determine if formalized expectation setting and bundled consent for invasive procedures upon admission impacts the acute stress burden on parents. Design. Prospective cluster randomized control trial. Setting, single center, tertiary PICU. Subjects, parents or guardians of patients 0 to 18 years old admitted to the PICU. Interventions, during experimental weeks, all patients admitted to the PICU were bundled consented for common procedures and given a novel unit introductory letter and document entitled Common Procedures Explained. During control weeks, all patients were consented for invasive procedures with separate consents for each procedure. Parents then completed a demographic survey and stress overload scale short 48 to 72 hours after their child's admission. For each participant, the stress overload scale short generates a personal vulnerability score and an event load score. Parents' perception of the life-threatening nature of their child's condition was also evaluated. Measurements and main results. Over 73 weeks, 1,882 patients were screened, and 261 consented to the stress overload scale short. Median personal vulnerability score was 10.4 in the control group and 9.1 in the experimental group, with a p-value equal to 0.15. Median event load score was 11.3 for the control group and 10.5 in the experimental group, with a p-value equal to 0.42. Adjusting for demographic variables and severity of illness, there was no independent association between either personal vulnerability or event load and bundled consent. However, a parent's perception of threat to life was significantly related to the allocated group, with a p-value equal to 0.036, which resulted in a decreased percentage of parents who rated their child's illness as extremely life-threatening. Experimental group was 17% versus control group 26%. Conclusions. This study did not demonstrate a decrease in stress when bundled consent was obtained. However, this intervention decreased the parent's perceived severity of illness. Further multicenter studies are needed to evaluate the effects of bundled consent on parents. Abstract 8 is an online clinical investigation by Holton et al. Admission partial pressure of oxygen and mortality among PICU patients in select diagnostic subgroups. Objectives. Evaluate the relationship between admission partial pressure of oxygen and mortality in a large multicenter data set and among diagnostic subgroups. Design. Retrospective cohort study. Setting. North American PICUs participating in the Virtual Pediatric Systems LLC, or VPS, from 2015 to 2019. Patients. Non-cardiac patients 18 years or younger admitted to a VPS PICU with admission partial pressure of oxygen. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. 13,071 patient encounters were included with an overall mortality of 13.52%. Age categories were equally distributed among survivors and non-survivors, with the exception of small differences among neonates and adolescents. Importantly, there was a tightly fitting quadratic relationship between admission partial pressure of oxygen and mortality, with the highest mortality rates seen among hypoxemic and hyperoxemic patients, likelihood ratio test, p-value less than 0.001. This relationship persisted after adjustment for illness severity using modified pediatric index of mortality 3 scores. A similar U-shaped relationship was demonstrated among patients with diagnoses of trauma, head trauma, sepsis, renal failure, hemorrhagic shock, and drowning. However, among the 1,500 patients admitted following cardiac arrest, there was no clear relationship between admission partial pressure of oxygen and mortality. Conclusions. In a large multi-center pediatric cohort, admission partial pressure of oxygen demonstrates a tightly fitting quadratic relationship with mortality. The persistence of this relationship among some but not all diagnostic subgroups suggests the pathophysiology of certain disease states may modify the hyperoxemia association. Abstract 9 is an online clinical investigation by O'Hara et al. Long-term functional outcomes at 1 year after hospital discharge in critically ill neonates with congenital diaphragmatic hernia. Objectives. Congenital diaphragmatic hernia, or CDH, is a birth defect associated with long-term morbidity. Our objective was to examine longitudinal change in functional status scale after hospital discharge in CDH survivors. Design. Single-center retrospective cohort study. Setting. Center for Comprehensive CDH Management at a Quaternary Freestanding Children's Hospital. Patients. Infants with Bactroban CDH were admitted to the ICU between January 2009 and December 2019 and survived until hospital discharge. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. 142 infants, 58% male, mean birth weight 3.08 kilograms, 80% left-sided defects, met inclusion criteria. Relevant clinical data were extracted from the medical record to calculate functional status scale, which was the primary outcome, at hospital discharge and three subsequent outpatient follow-up time points. The median functional status scale score at hospital discharge was 8, with an interquartile range of 7 to 9. 39 patients, or 27.5%, had at least moderate impairment with the functional status scale score greater than or equal to 9. Median functional status scale at 0 to 6 months was 7, with an interquartile range of 7 to 8 and an N equal to 141. Median functional status scale of 6 to 12 months was 7, with an interquartile range of 6 to 8 and an N equal to 141. And median functional status scale over 12 months was 6, with an interquartile range of 6 to 7 and an N equal to 140. 21 patients, or 15%, had at least moderate impairment at over 12-month follow-up. Median composite functional status scale scores in the over 12-month time point decreased by 2 points from hospital discharge. Median feeding domain scores improved by 1 with an interquartile range of 1 to 2, whereas other domain scores remained without impairment. Multivariable analysis demonstrated right-sided C or D size defects, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation use, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and chromosomal anomalies were associated with impairment. Conclusions. The majority of CDH survivors at our center had mild functional status impairment with a score less than or equal to 8 at discharge and 1 year follow-up. However, nearly 15% of patients had moderate impairment during this time period. The feeding domain had the highest level of functional impairment. We observed unchanged or improving functional status longitudinally over 1 year follow-up after hospital discharge. Longitudinal outcomes will guide interdisciplinary management strategies in CDH survivors. Abstract 10 is an online review article by Dennis et al. Enteral Nutrition During Extracorporeal Membrane Oxygenation in the Neonatal and Pediatric Populations, a literature review. Objectives. The number of infants and children requiring extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, is rising. While critically ill, providers may believe that enteral nutrition puts the patient at risk for severe complications such as necrotizing enterocolitis. However, enteral nutrition is associated with the potential to improve the gut barrier and reduce the risk of morbidity and mortality. The purpose of this article is to review the existing evidence about providing exclusive enteral and parenteral nutrition and its association with rates of complications and mortality in critically ill neonatal and pediatric populations on ECMO. Data sources. Literature addressing enteral nutrition while on ECMO for neonatal and pediatric populations was searched using PubMed, CINAHL, and Scopus. Study selection. Studies range from 1998 to 2022 and were conducted mostly in the PICU and neonatal ICU settings. Data extraction. 14 articles were reviewed after inclusion and exclusion criteria were applied. Data synthesis. Characteristics included an even number of males and females in samples from mostly PICUs. The predominant underlying illnesses were neonatal pulmonary disease and cardiac disease. Upon reviewing the literature, three major themes were revealed: no significant complications with enteral feeding, underutilization of enteral feeding, and reduced mortality with enteral feeding. Conclusion: the use of enteral nutrition in the neonatal and pediatric population while on ECMO has the potential to improve survival rates and reduce complications. Further studies are needed to investigate how to optimize this population's nutrition and develop feeding protocols and pathways. Abstract 11 is an online brief report by Gray et al. Inappropriate shock delivery is common during pediatric in-hospital cardiac arrest. Objectives: to characterize inappropriate shock delivery during pediatric in-hospital cardiac arrest. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting: an International Pediatric Cardiac Arrest Quality Improvement Collaborative, Pediatric Resuscitation Quality, or PDResQ. Patients: all in-hospital cardiac arrest events from 2015 to 2020 from the PDResQ Collaborative, for which shock and electrocardiogram waveform data were available. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We analyzed 418 shocks delivered during 159 cardiac arrest events, with 381 shocks during 158 events at 28 sites remaining after excluding undecipherable rhythms. We classified shocks as the following: 1. Appropriate, with ventricular fibrillation or wide complex greater than or equal to 150 per minute. 2. Indeterminate, with narrow complex greater than or equal to 150 per minute or wide complex 100 to 149 per minute. Or 3. Inappropriate, with asystole, sinus, or narrow complex less than 150 per minute or wide complex less than 100 per minute, based on the rhythm immediately preceding shock delivery. Of delivered shocks, 57% were delivered appropriately for ventricular fibrillation or wide complex rhythms with a rate greater than or equal to 150 per minute. 13% were classified as indeterminate. 30% were delivered inappropriately for asystole, 6.8%, sinus rhythm, 3.1%, narrow complex rhythm less than 150 per minute, 11%, or wide complex rhythm less than 100 per minute, 8.9%. 88% of all shocks were delivered in ICUs or emergency departments, and 30% of those were delivered inappropriately. Conclusions: the rate of inappropriate shock delivery for pediatric in-hospital cardiac arrest in this international cohort is at least 30%, with 23% delivered to an organized electrical rhythm, identifying opportunity for improvement in rhythm identification training. Abstract 12 is an online brief report by Pineda et al. Asthma cases treated with inhaled anesthetics or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, a virtual pediatric systems database study of outcomes. Objectives: extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, and or inhaled anesthetics are considered in the management of asthma when refractory to conventional therapy. We aimed to compare the outcomes of these two modalities in asthma PICU care and determine associated survival to hospital discharge among patients in a United States database. Design: retrospective analysis using the Virtual Pediatric Systems Database, or VPS. Setting: PICUs participating in the VPS database. Patients: patients less than 18 years old with diagnosis of asthma treated with inhaled anesthetics and or ECMO from January 2010 to December 2020. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. A total of 221 patients were included. 149, or 67%, received ECMO, 62, or 28%, received inhaled anesthetics, and 10, or 5%, received both interventions. We failed to identify any difference between the ECMO and inhaled anesthetic groups in demographics, pediatric index of mortality 2 percentage, pediatric risk of mortality 3 score, pediatric logistic organ dysfunction score, or pre-intervention pH and PaCO2 levels. Use of ECMO versus inhaled anesthetics was associated with lower pre-intervention PaO2, 60 TORS or 7.99 kilopascals versus 78 TORS or 10.39 kilopascals and a p-value less than 0.001, and higher utilization of high-frequency oscillatory ventilation. We failed to identify an association between type of intervention, inhaled anesthetic versus ECMO, and greater odds of survival, with 57 of 62, or 92%, versus 128, or 149, or 86%, an odds ratio of 1.87, 95% confidence interval of 0.67 to 5.21, and a p-value equal to 0.23. However, these data do not exclude the possibility that inhaled anesthetic use is associated with more than five-fold greater odds of survival. ECMO use was associated with longer duration of intervention, 5 versus 1.3 days, and a p-value less than 0.001, and PICU length of stay, 13 versus 7 days with a p-value less than 0.001. As expected, ECMO versus inhaled anesthetic was also associated with greater odds of undergoing bronchoscopy, 34% versus 11%, with an odds ratio of 3.7, a 95% confidence interval of 1.5 to 9.4, and a p-value equal to 0.004. Conclusions. In the VPS database of asthma management cases, we failed to identify an association between ECMO versus inhaled anesthetic use and survival to hospital discharge. However, ECMO was associated with longer duration of intervention and PICU length of stay. The PCCM narrative this month is by Dr. Jessica Bratt Carlisle, entitled The Exchange. I opened the list of new PICU admits from overnight, my eyes scanning the name, age, admitting diagnosis columns on the computer screen. As a chaplain, I can anticipate where I might be needed. Admitting diagnosis, drowning. My heart sinks. I feel a brief nostalgia for the dark days of winter, where our unit is a blur of bronchiolitis, a sea of infants and toddlers who will mostly slowly but surely recover from their respiratory illnesses, the ICU a brief stopover on a journey that returns them home. But it's late spring now, the time of year when the census is increasingly punctuated with the hallmarks of warmer weather, outdoor adventures gone awry, the kind of split-second accidents that land someone's dear child in our unit. She was barely two, with silky brown pigtails. They thought the gate to the pool was closed. It wasn't. Later that morning, I pause outside the door of her hospital room. The privacy curtain is drawn, adding to the atmosphere of hushed communal awareness that any life-saving emergency is behind us, that the team is no longer wringing their hands over whether recovery is possible. The questions now are about timing. How soon will we be beyond certain that this sweet, curious toddler cannot survive all of those missing minutes of oxygen to her brain? How soon will her numb parents be able to grasp that? How could anyone grasp it, ever? Soon it's clear that the perfect little body will never be animated again, save for the machines we have plugged into the wall and into her. Anoxic brain damage is so sinister in its invisibility. Nothing my eye observes can account for why this little girl, who seems outwardly unscathed, will never wake up. The organ donation representatives are nearby, doing their due diligence to sort out what might be possible if by some stretch of love these parents can let the tragic loss of their own child save the lives of other children. It's a remarkable, delicate dance, and rightly so. Her parents show us pictures from a recent family photo session. We share their disbelief that this could be happening. We join their collective shock and sorrow. But for us as staff, it's an all too familiar shock and sorrow. Too many times we have seen pictures depicting kids in this unit before whatever the after is that rendered them in need of an intensive care bed. The little girl's parents decide to donate her organs, wondering aloud whether the miracle they prayed for might be unfolding, just very differently than they'd hoped. Maybe, they ventured, all those efforts to resuscitate her, futile as they seemed when the outcome ended up being dismal, sustained her body just long enough to become someone else's longed-for miracle. My mind wanders to past moments spent with patients and parents on the recipient side of the heart or lung transplant process, as they agonize over knowing they are waiting for someone else's tragedy to become their own family's opportunity. It's a horribly complex thing to pray for. Sometimes all of it feels like a miracle to me, that humans have persevered in scientific achievement to the point where organ donation and transplant are even possible. It astonishes me. I hope it always does. I recall other occasions where parents decline to pursue donating their child's organs because they cannot bear to wait any longer for the final breath they know is imminent. It can take a few days to match organs with the right recipients and map out logistics, and for many families, such a drawn-out timeline is understandably too much to endure. But for this particular family, a couple more days with their daughter means cherished extra time. During that interlude, her room feels more funeral than medical. The nurses care tenderly for their patient in her last days, holding the paradoxical knowledge that nothing they do can restore her, but everything they do might improve the outcome for those unseen children out there who, we hope, will have a new lease on life through the gift of these precious organs. A plan and schedule emerge for the organ procurement, but then there's the matter of how we will care for the girl's parents, whose own bodies somehow need to leave her side, leave the hospital, and return to a life without her. On that final morning, before it is time to take her down to the operating room, the little girl is held for the last time in the tight embrace of her mother, who seems to enfold her daughter with every fiber of her being. I think back to the day they arrived, when I met the girl's dad and asked him at the bedside, as I often do with parents, "What do you feel like you need most right now?" Without hesitation, he said, "To take her place." The anguish is palpable as we staff whisper among ourselves, strategizing how best to facilitate the parents' eventual departure. No matter how many times we have helped in those awful and inevitable moments, it feels horrifying that any of us should dare to pry a mother or father from the flesh of their own future, whose suffering they would gladly absorb if they could. I gently suggest to the mother that it is time to let herself be enfolded with love and care just as she has been enfolding her daughter these last 3 days. It's time to let your family hold you just as you've held her. The organ donation coordinator steps in to update the family that their daughter's heart, lung, and kidneys have been placed with matching donors. Somehow, it helps cue her parents that the life within her is needed elsewhere, that it is time to let her go. I am asked to pray, and as I finish, the dad starts praying too, sobbing in the bewildered, humble wisdom of the faith that has carried him through this, lamenting, "God, we have prayed for so many others in tragedy. We never thought it would be us." As I leave the hospital later that day, descending to the depths of the building out a staff exit hallway, I step off the elevator adjacent to the operating rooms. The organ procurement team is stepping on another elevator, cooler in hand, heading up to the waiting helicopters. She is gone, but her life is now inextricably intertwined with others, the physical connection enduring. There is a child out there breathing through those very lungs, another child whose pulse beats with that same heart. What mysteries we witness. What annihilation. What hope. I will carry it with me. This concludes the abstracts for the August issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.